Welcome, and thank you for joining us for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. I am your host, Dan Sampson, and I'm joined today by NAHU Government Affairs staff members Marcy Buckner and Chris Hartman. On this episode, for the week ending Friday, May 11th, we'll discuss the Trump administration's America First prescription drug plan, the recent developments in bipartisan market stability, changes underway for Medicare Advantage, and when we can expect the Association Health Plan regulations. Before we begin, as a reminder, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and to rate us. The podcast is posted every Friday on these channels ahead of being distributed through the Washington Update, giving you a head start on your weekly healthcare happy hour. With that, I want to welcome our panelists to the show once again. Today, we are joined by Marcy Buckner and Chris Hartman. As we start off the Washington Update podcast, or WUP, what has been the big whoop this week?
The big whoop of the week is that we are expecting a big announcement on Friday from President Trump and Secretary Azar to release their prescription drug plan. So this is something that we have been expecting for quite some time, not just because the cost of prescription drugs is something that the president touted while he was campaigning, but also because they have actually scheduled this conference or this release earlier in the year, a couple of weeks ago, but with Secretary Azar's illness and hospitalization, they ended up pushing it back. So we are expecting this to happen on Friday. We are here recording on Thursday, May 10th, and the announcement is expected for the afternoon on May 11th. And there are a number of different things that folks are expecting. Not too much has been leaked out as far as what we can expect to hear from the Rose Garden tomorrow. There are some concerns that the announcement may even be postponed later than that, but now that we're almost 24 hours out, it looks like we are going to hear from Secretary Azar and the president. There is some speculation that, among other things, the proposal will combine Medicare Part B hospital or physician-administered drug programs with Medicare Part D outpatient drug programs, under which the pharmaceutical benefit management firms negotiate the prices with manufacturers as a way to try to lower the drug prices by combining those programs. There has been an attempt in the past to pass legislation that would establish a Medicare Part D mandatory discount that would be similar to the Medicaid prescription coverage, and it would at least cover dual eligibles. So these are some of the things that we could see, but there are other areas, obviously, wanting to get into the private market, and I don't think that we are going to get away with having an announcement here that doesn't in some way touch on the opioid crisis. As we've mentioned in the past, talking about mental health parity and the effect that has had on employer-sponsored plans over the past couple of weeks with action that's been happening at Congress, every agency, every committee wants a piece of the opioid action and to show that they're doing something because it is such a horrible epidemic in this country. So I would expect for the announcement tomorrow to include something on access to opioids, and as well as just looking at the overall prescription drug prices that have really been ravaging the country. And that's the big whip of the week.
Senate Help Committee Chairman Lamar Alexander sent a letter to NAHU and other healthcare stakeholders this week stating that market stability efforts have all but ended, and he is refocusing his attention on other healthcare issues. What happened to cause this dim outlook, and is Alexander's statement indicative that there is no hope for stability?
So Chairman Alexander sent a strongly stated letter out to the members in the Senate on the Republican side of the aisle who've been working with him on market stability, reinsurance, cost-share reductions, blaming the Democrats and Ranking Member Murray for walking away from the table on market stability. Senator Murray and the Democrats quickly responded with saying, we're still at the table. You've walked away from the table on market stability, reinsurance, cost share reductions. So we're stuck in this cycle of finger pointing now. And I think why we've hit this moment and why this letter got sent is because last week we saw the first of the rates starting to come out. And in Maryland, Virginia, several others, rates have started coming out, most of which are in the double digits. Sometimes we've seen them as high as 60, 70% increases in rates. So this was going to lead to one of two reactions. One reaction would be the movement to actually get market stability now that we've seen rates that have gotten as high as the 60 or 7%. Or two, the unfortunate reaction where we are now that, well, if the rates are going to go up by double digits, somebody has to be somebody's fault and somebody's to blame. So I think we are stuck in this cycle of finger pointing. And every time the rates come out, I think you'll see the Democrats blame Republicans for zeroing out the penalty on the individual mandate for the year 2019, which is the rates that we're looking at. Also for President Trump eliminating the cost sharing reductions, for the risk corridor funding going away. Other sorts of things that have led that. The Republicans will point fingers every time the rates come out that, see, the ACA isn't working. This is the Obamacare. Obamacare leads to higher rates. So I think we're going to be in this cycle of blaming that's going on. I think as association healthcare plans and short-term duration plans continue to be in the news, Democrats will also point to those as a reason the carriers are raising rates. Association healthcare plans and short-term duration plans. Academics and actuaries have been worried we'll take healthy risk and take them out of the individual market and therefore make rates even higher. So I think we're stuck into this really bad cycle of finger pointing that unfortunately I don't think ends until after the election.
Right. I think the most frustrating part of this cycle and the finger pointing is that at this point, we were kind of hoping that instead of seeing the letter that we received from Alexander saying that they fear negotiations are over on this issue, at this point in the year, we were hoping to see them really coming together and trying to get something done before the election so they could go home and tout whatever progress they were able to make on market stabilization. And that's really where we wanted to be. And so to have this come out and have with the indication that we are just in a further kind of cyclone of these negotiations falling apart is very disappointing. And of course, NEHU awarded Senator Alexander and Murray with the Spirit of Independence Award for their efforts last year to come together with a bipartisan bill on market stability. So now to be in this position where we're further away from coming together on those compromises, that's really not where we wanted to be at this point. But we are still in an election year. And like you mentioned, it may take until after the election, or possibly we'll get an October surprise of folks wanting to come together and get something done before their constituents hit the polls.
Yeah, right now, I think we're stuck in this cycle of hurt feelings. I think Chairman Alexander was particularly upset by the Minority Leader Chuck Schumer's constant press releases each time a carrier released their insurance rates, blaming the Republicans. I think right now, I think what can bring them back together, unfortunately, might just be time. Chairman Alexander and Ranking Member Murray really do work well together, but I think right now they are upset at each other, and that's the sort of thing that time heals. So I think we might be later this year when the rate season has ended, the press release season and tweet season has calmed down regarding the individual market rates for the new year. I think we have another shot at trying to do the market stability. But for the short term, I think we'll just continue to see carriers putting out their rates for the states. They will be in the double digit category, and we won't see much else about that. And I think the Trump administration's response to that will be, this is why we need association healthcare plans and short-term duration plans.
The White House and congressional Republicans are seeking to advance a rescissions package that would claw back roughly $15 billion in spending from the $1.3 trillion omnibus spending package that President Trump signed into law back in March. How does this process work, and what could it mean for federal healthcare spending?
So the ability to rescind these funds is something that was put together in an act in 1974, and it gives the president the authority to propose rescinding specific funding previously approved by Congress. However, that rescission does also require Congress to pass legislation. So the law would allow for the president to freeze the funds that are currently being considered for rescission for 45 days. So that's the time period that we're in now. And the rescissions are also able to be approved with a simple majority in both houses. So just a simple majority in the House and the Senate. That is important to note before we kind of get into what is in the rescission package. But the ability for Congress to approve these rescissions with a simple majority vote is key, because we have to look over to the Senate, where, yes, there are 51 Republicans in the Senate, but currently Senator McCain will probably not be making it back for a vote on this by mid-June. And so they will be in a position where they will need all Republicans to vote in favor of the rescissions in order for it to pass. And then, of course, have Vice President Pence come and cast that tie-breaking vote. So the logistics of this are also almost just as important as the fact that they are trying to go through with this rescission package. It's also important to note that since 1974, since this law passed allowing presidents to request these rescissions from Congress, 40% of the presidential rescission proposals have been enacted in some form. The most recent was President Clinton engaging in using this act. So this isn't something that is unheard of. It's something that happens somewhat often. However, with the $15.4 billion rescission request, this is the largest request for a rescission package ever using presidential authority. So even though it does happen quite often in different presidential administrations, this would be the largest amount that they would be looking at. And some of the pieces that are under scrutiny of being rescinded are sections that would affect the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP. Right now, what they're looking at would contain $7 billion in funds that they say are no longer necessary or can't be spent because the authority to spend those funds expired last year. So they're trying to rescind that kind of on paper just to show a savings in that manner, but it doesn't mean that those funds will not be spent in other ways later on.
You know, Congress just reauthorized the Children's Health Insurance Program for a period of 10 years in a very bipartisan manner. I guess I'm going to find it a little hard to believe or surprising that after last year just extending the Children's Health Insurance Program and providing funding for that, we're now going to be in a situation where cutting the Children's Health Insurance Program. But that seems to be the bulk of the rescission package that's out there. I think for us, there's not only the concern, obviously, that children are using the CHIP program, and we want to make sure that children get the healthcare they need, but also when states start removing children from CHIP programs, that you start destabilizing the insurance market in other areas, because they might be looking to go, then the family might need to put them in the individual market or into the group market or put them on a business's insurance plan. So all these changes that you see in one section of healthcare have an effect on all sorts of market stability, on the individual, small group, large group, self-insurance markets that are out there.
And it's important to note, like Chris is mentioning, when you take these funds away, obviously the children are going to go somewhere. There's an attempt to place them. And part of the cuts in funding is to the Child Enrollment Contingency Fund, which does just that, tries to find a place for coverage for these children. So not only are they taking funds away from CHIP, they're also taking funds away from programs specifically within CHIP that help to make sure that these children are able to be placed if they're not placed in the Children's Health Insurance Program. Also, while we're watching this, as much as I have recently just said that it's $15.4 billion and it's the largest rescission program, when we're looking at this, it only represents less than 0.4% of total government spending this year, which I know makes us sound like we're acting like $15.4 billion isn't a lot of money. It is a lot of money, especially when we're looking at the programs that they're looking at cutting. But when we look at it in the total scheme of the budget, like I said, it's less than 0.4% of that. I think also when we're looking at the politics of this, There have been some Republicans that have come out and been very skeptical of this. Susan Collins from Maine is one of those senators. And I think here she's very concerned about the cuts in CHIP for her state. And also, we can't forget that she, kind of like Chris was talking about Alexander and Murray having some hurt feelings, Collins has some hurt feelings about saying that she was trading in her vote in favor of tax reform in December for a vote on her reinsurance funding. She hasn't gotten that reinsurance funding vote yet. And so I think some of those feelings might come into play here, where she may say, you know, I cannot vote in favor of a rescission package that's taking money away from the children in my state, while I'm also have not been able to progress with the reinsurance package that she has been trying to get passed. So there are a lot of different moving pieces here, just with looking at not just what's in the bill, but also the process on how this could go.
So I'm a little cynical about this whole particular process, particularly as we get closer to Election Day. You know, for the last year and a half, Congress and the federal government has been spending like drunken sailors. The deficits are increasing wildly. I think you're going to find, as the Congressional Budget Office and OMB come out with their deficit forecast for the future, we're going to see things getting more and more out of control, less revenues coming in, but spending is going up. And so I think we're now in the season of trying to prove back home that we're actually doing something about this. The House of Representatives, suddenly, after a year and a half of all this spending, says, oh, we're going to pass a balanced budget amendment to amend the Constitution to pass the balanced budget. Now they're coming out with, we're going to rescind $15 billion in spending here. But I just think these are messaging pieces. I'm very cynical. I think it's to make the American public think that we're doing something in Washington about spending, and we're doing something about the deficit and debt. But is any of this really going to happen? Mitch McConnell seems to have no interest in actually taking up a rescission plan in the Senate. I think the House will probably pass this fairly easily so they can go home and campaign on this. But doesn't everybody secretly know this isn't really going to happen? And it might make a nice little bullet point on the campaign literature that shows up in your mailbox. So I'm pretty cynical about this. I think this is sort of Washington as usual here. As much as I am concerned about children and their health insurance, I guess I don't see this as that big a threat, because I don't really see any of this happening at the end of the day. And as we get closer to Election Day, I think a lot of these bills, that particularly bills that make the cable news or social media and other things like that, are the sort of things that are more about election time and less about real people's lives.
And we are going to see more and more of these packages. Mick Mulvaney, director of the Office of Management and Budget, said that he wanted to initially do a larger rescission package with this specific piece. But then the White House has also reported that they have other packages in mind to try to get up to a total of $25 billion in cuts. So I think this is just their first effort in trying to show that they're trying to cut back on some of these funds. It's also a way that President Trump is trying to take control on the budget. He did request or demanded that Congress give him line item veto power on spending bills. The Supreme Court did say that that is unconstitutional. So he's not able to have that power. And I think using this tool, using the rescission process, is one of his ways of trying to take control in that area of spending. But like I said, the funds are now frozen, so to speak, for 45 days, and Congress has 25 legislative days to mark up the bill. So this will move pretty quickly. And I agree with Chris. I think it'll pass the House very easily, and then we'll get kind of bogged down in the Senate, and then we'll be back to square one and looking to see if they try to float a different type of rescission package later on to try to get to that $25 billion in cuts that they're looking at as a goal.
Yeah, Marcy, you talked about the statistics about the percentage of these passing, that quite a few of these have been done in the past. But I think it's also interesting to note that none of these have happened since essentially 1994. And so the fact that they haven't really been used in the last 20 years, I think, shows you that Congress isn't really in the direction of being able to do just a cut bill standalone. I think if Congress is looking to to cut spending, they've done that more in larger packages overall, where you can see things cut, but also people get other things they particularly want in the bill. I think it's going to be hard to pass something that's a cut-only piece of legislation and get people to vote for it.
It's now time for the senior moment. The House held a hearing this week on issues in Medicare Advantage. What are some of the new innovations underway by CMS with regards to Plan Finder, as well as providing a more individualized care and benefits for beneficiaries?
So our buddy John Green is out this week traveling to the local chapters. And so our senior moment this week is something that I put together. The House of Representatives had a fascinating hearing this week on Medicare Advantage and some of the innovations that are going underway at Medicare Advantage. They had a very good hearing with some of the different plans who were involved in Medicare Advantage, such as Independence Blue Cross Blue Shield, some academics from Georgetown University and University of Miami, and some of the technology officers are out there. I think people talked a little bit about the difficulty consumers have using Plan Finder, and I think agents and brokers really get this piece, that Plan Finder was supposed to be something that a senior could easily use to figure out which plan to use, and it's not that simple. It's much harder to be able to use this technology, and as we all know, as you get a little older, you might not be as tech savvy as some of the younger people. So I think the real lesson that came out of there are some of the continued problems with Plan Finder, but also a reinforcement of the value of an agent and broker to be able to help seniors with Medicare Advantage plans and getting into the right one.
And I think another issue with the Plan Finder is sometimes there aren't plans to be found very easily. There, just as we talk about the lack of choice and availability in the private market, oftentimes that same issue arises in Medicare. And I know that was something that was brought up during the hearing, both the availability of plans and the willingness of practitioners to contract into some of the networks. So with the Plan Finder, it becomes increasingly difficult if you're in an area that doesn't have as many plans available. And then just to reiterate what Chris's point, that then becomes an ideal situation for a consumer to be able to work with an agent or broker to be able to place them in something, because we know that there's going to be something available to them. It just might be a little bit more difficult of an arrangement to place them.
A couple of other interesting things that happened in the conversation that I know our agents who work in MA know quite a bit is the Star Ratings Program. There was some conversations about the Star Ratings Program needs to be adjusted more for regional differences in plans that are out there. We all know urban America is very different than rural America, and the Star Rating Program needs to be able to take a different look at how MA programs work in those areas. While still holding hospitals to high standards, I think we need to make adjustments for what sort of communities that are out there. And so that was kind of part of the conversation that went on during the hearing. A couple of the others were about the new value-based design plans that are increasingly available within the MA. And if you'll remember, value-based design plans design a plan around the person, and they particularly reward people for what works and for their chronic, to make sure they take care of their chronic problems and diseases. For example, if you have diabetes, to make sure that you are not only getting for free, but the whole entire system is incentivized for you taking your medication for diabetes ahead of time, so your problems don't get worse and then you're actually more expensive on the system. A lot of conversation about these value-based design plans coming in, allowing more creativity and diversity in the plans out there, but that will also make things more complicated. The more variation in the type of MA plans out there, I think, though, again, that's why agents and brokers will be necessary, because I think we are on the verge of seeing more complicated MA plans. And I think that's good for you as the consumer to be able to have a plan that fits more of your needs. At the same time, that's going to be a lot more complicated for people to understand the different plans that are available at them. And so agents and brokers are going to need to keep up. The Plan Finder that people were already having difficulty with won't be able to keep up with those sorts of things. So I think this is going to be a useful discussion about Medicare Advantage plans as we see more ones that are complicatedly designed.
And of course, we do appreciate what's happening in the Medicare Advantage market with the use of value-based design and creating these more flexible plans. This is something that we would like to see also being mimicked in the private market. So it is encouraging to see these issues being brought up in the hearing and being further discussed and also being used as examples of some best practices that could possibly bleed over and start being used in the private market.
I think a lot of interesting conversation that continue to go on there is also about the data claims availability to researchers. A lot of Medicare information is slowly finally getting out there to the public to find out what things cost, at least comes to Medicare. We don't have that everywhere else, but there's Medicare data is slowly getting out there to find what hospitals are charging, what doctors are charging, what the pharmaceutical companies are charging for their different drugs, and being allowing people to start to be able to compare that. So we might not have that for the whole industry, but Medicare Advantage and MA has slowly had that data going out there. And I think that's going to be useful for companies, for researchers, for brokers, to be able to help people navigate those costs out there. So they're finding things that are cheaper, but also things that work. So often people assume the most expensive thing is the thing that's best for them. But we find in healthcare, quality and cost don't correlate in any sort of way. And so making sure that star rating programs, other incentives are based around what works and not just what the expenses are.
And of course, all of this ties together in one way or another, looking at those points on cost transparency and others. If you remember a couple of weeks ago, I mentioned that CMS came out with a request for information looking at ways to enforce some of the rules about hospitals revealing their prices within Medicare plans. So I think it's no surprise that this topic came up again in the hearing. The comments that are due on that or proposed rule aren't for another couple of weeks. But again, these themes are definitely overlapping, and we're seeing them come up not just on the legislative side in these congressional hearings, but also in attempts from the administration and CMS to try to take control of these transparency issues.
Before we wrap up the show for the week, we'll look ahead at what's on tap for next week, both with Congress and from the administration. What's on tap?
What's on tap for next week is Congress is back in session, for good or for bad, as we have
at least until Memorial Day.
At least until Memorial Day. And then they'll go on their summer break, where I think we will see a lot more action on the regulatory side while Congress is away. But we could also see some of those hurt feelings being mended while they're away over the summer and not constantly being here trying to negotiate and seeing each other in person. What else we can expect, and an update kind of on where we are with the association health plan regulations. We have heard that the AHP final rule is over at the Office of Management and Budget at OMB, and the process for rulemaking when a final rule is about to be released, kind of the last stop is OMB before it goes public, stopping there for a final review. So we have heard that the association health plan has been over at OMB for about a week or two. So we can expect to see that possibly in June or July, which is a little earlier than I've been predicting on some of our earlier podcasts. So with a release in the June-July timeframe, this will be in time for plans to adjust, to submit their rates and work with the state regulators to submit rates in a world where association health plans will be in effect. Some plans have already done that. Some plans that were working on their plan designs went ahead and assumed that this rule was going to go into place before they, as carriers, submitted their plans for approval. Others did not, but knowing now that this rule is going to come out sooner rather than later, we do know that carriers will have time to adjust their rates if needed, because this will be in effect for 2019 plans.
And I think for Congress, for the following week, it's going to be opioids, opioids, and more opioids. The continuing conversation on Congress around opioid abuse will be the big hit. This past week, we saw 20-something plans marked up in the Energy and Commerce Committee. We're going to see another couple of dozen plans marked up in the Energy and Commerce Committee. Every lobbyist in town is trying to figure out how to attach their issue to opioid abuse. I think Congress will be looking at every way possible to deal with opioid abuse. Do all of these ideas actually work? I think that will take some time to tell, but they're right now sort of throwing all of the spaghetti against the wall and seeing what sticks. And so I think for the next few weeks, that will be the number one topic in healthcare and Congress, and you'll continue to see every politician trying to deal with this problem that is a real problem throughout our country and that's damaging our workforce and damaging our long-term health. And really is, I think, one of the reasons I think you're seeing life expectancy start to drop in the United States. But we need to figure out what works and not just trying to throw every idea at the wall there. We'll keep keeping an eye on things that could damage employers, like penalizing them for not having proper mental health parity programs to deal with opioid abuse. I think every employer wants to get their employees to get proper health care for opioid abuse, but we don't want to start willy-nilly throwing around penalties against employers. And so we're going to keep an eye on that as this process continues. Because if you'll remember a week or two ago on the Senate side, we ran into some problems where they wanted to start penalizing employers for that. And, you know, it's a real problem if you're an employer and you're buying a fully insured healthcare product, you're assuming that healthcare carrier is giving you an adequate network. There's sort of an assumption of good faith going on there. And so we want to make sure employers don't end up holding the bag as we are dealing with the opioid problem that's out there.
And of course, on tap for next week will be any follow-up or any actions taken by the administration or directives given to Congress as a result of President Trump and Secretary Azar's prescription drug announcement that will be happening in the Rose Garden on Friday.
Yeah, I think even when it happens on Friday, this is going to be a continuing issue. Prescription drug costs obviously are a huge issue for everyone, regardless of age, regardless of individual market, employer-based market. And so this is going to be a continued conversation of how do we keep these costs down while allowing America to continue to be the innovator of the world.
It's now time for the toast of the week. What are we celebrating this week?
Thanks, Dan. This week we are toasting to our magazine, America's Benefits Specialist, and to note a particular article on UBA's health plan surveys looking at trends in the small and large group market and what sort of plan options are happening over in the overall market. It's a great read about the way healthcare is going in America.
So, of course, keep an eye out in your mailboxes for the new edition of the magazine, and it's also available online.
To America's Benefits Specialists.
Cheers!
Thank you for joining us for this week's installment of the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. For more information on NAHU's government affairs efforts, and to join as a member of NAHU, visit nahu.org.